I'm delighted to be here. I've enjoyed my time here at Perimeter enormously, and I've gained a huge amount from it. When I was thinking about what I might contribute today, of course, it has something to do with the notion of time. I thought I would talk about time and clocks. There's obviously some kind of connection between them, but the connection, it seems to me, is somewhat curious. And although I'm going to be speaking today about some very, very elementary things in physics aren't always very simple. And that's what I'm going to try to look at today. How do these very elementary notions about time and clocks work in physics? Well, I'm going to start just by making some broad comments about the multifaceted nature of time in physics. Then I want to say something about time and thermodynamics. Well, why thermodynamics? Because thermodynamics is a theory that has time in a sense, but it has no clocks. It has no temporal metric. But it also has other characteristics that I think are worth looking at. And in particular, when we come back to think about general relativity a bit later on. Then I want to look at the question, if this is a question, for example, that Julian Barber has been pounding on about for many years now. What is a clock? And in particular, Julian has been pointing out that if you look at Einstein's 1905 paper, although it has this very, very operational flavor in terms of the workings of rods and clocks, you will never find a definition of a clock in that paper, and that's essentially true. So what did Einstein think he meant by a clock, and what is the correct way of thinking about it? And I'm going to argue that Newton, in fact, had a much better understanding of what a clock is than Einstein. Now, we're looking, by asking ourselves what we mean by an ideal clock, in the first instance, we're asking what it is about the periodicity of the clock that makes it ideal. So I want to separate two aspects of a clock. A clock has a periodic behavior. It has a certain regularity, according to some standard, but it also has a phase. So in the first instance, I'm not concerned about the phase of a clock. And in particular, I'm not concerned about how we spread the phase of the clock through space. In other words, I'm not interested in the question of simultaneity. I simply want to understand what it means to talk about the duration between events at a single place. Now, once we understand roughly what we mean by a clock and how it works, and in particular how it works in special relativity, I just want to make some remarks about time dilation, about the so-called clock hypothesis that holds for accelerating clocks. After all, Einstein's special theory of relativity in 1905 tells you what a uniformly moving clock will do in relation to stationary synchronized clocks. But what's supposed to happen when it accelerates? Well, this is where the so-called clock hypothesis comes in. And then I want to say something about how we're supposed to understand time dilation in the context of general relativity. Where does general relativity, by the way, even pick up the idea of a metric, a temporal metric? Where does that come in? There, I thought we could have a break. And then after the break, I'll say a few remarks about simultaneity and the conventionality of distance simultaneity and the relativity of simultaneity, but more indeed about the conventionality. The conventionality of distance simultaneity, the claim that the relationship of simultaneity between distant events is a convention, really goes back mostly to Poincaré, who saw this conventionality both in classical physics and in relativistic physics. He was the first to understand the relativity of simultaneity that were built into Lorentz transformations. This question about the conventionality of distance simultaneity, at least in the philosophical literature on space and time, has given rise to more debate, more papers, more ink, and more hot air than any other subject I'm aware of. So I just want to give you a sense as to why the philosophers are so concerned with this issue, the conventionality of distance simultaneity. Well, yesterday, we watched a wonderful video recording of a lecture by Chris Isham, and he said that everybody who uses PowerPoint has to put in a quote. So I thought I'd put in a few quotes about, let's ask ourselves, what is time? Well, we could ask ourselves the question, what are the necessary and sufficient conditions for a theory in physics to contain time? And I am far from clear that that's a well-defined question. time is very, very multifaceted. But let's start with the following claim that has been attributed, I've seen it attributed to Wheeler, and I think I've also seen it attributed to Einstein. Time is what stops everything happening at once. Well, another way of putting exactly the same idea is that time is nature's way of getting around the law of non-contradiction. So, for example, my hand is up and my hand is down. Those are two propositions that are clearly inconsistent. Don't we have a law in metaphysics about the law of non-contradiction? Aren't we supposed to avoid contradictions like mad? Well, this is nature's way of getting around the law of non-contradiction because we simply say that these propositions are associated with different times. Have we explained anything? Maybe that's just what time is. At the very least, it seems to me that if we're going to talk about time in physics, we need the notion of a multiplicity, maybe a multiplicity of configurations of a system or states of a system. So, for example, in mechanics, if we're characterizing a system by way of a configuration space, so every point in the configuration space, or phase space, if you like, corresponds to a particular instantaneous configuration of a body, then presumably, if you've only got one point of interest in the space, or the system finds itself at that point and never leaves it, it's difficult to talk about time. So maybe what we're looking for is something like an orbit, or at least a collection of points in the configuration space that are realized by the system. Now, that doesn't mean that the thing is flowing, and it doesn't even necessarily mean that this is happening after that, or what the order is. There's just a heap, in Julian Barber's words, there's a heap of possibilities. There's a heap of arrangements of the world. And that's the first sense that we mean by time. And by the way, this is so fundamental that the title of Barber's book, The End of Time, is a terrible misnomer. Because he's assuming exactly this fundamental notion of time, of course, right from the beginning. It's the notion of a multiplicity of states of affairs. Now, there's another very nice quote from Barber, which is, instants are not in time, time is an instance. Now, what does he mean by that? What he means is the following. If we take a particular typical instantaneous state of the world, such as the instant now, just by direct inspection, if I look outside, I can see trees that have rings in them. If I look in the distance, I can see mountains with strata. And I've got memories that I can access instantaneously. In other words, we have records of the past. We have records of the past. Now, of course, they require a certain amount of interpretation. We don't actually have access to the past any more than we have access to the future. We have access to instantaneous states of affairs, including the states of our brains, which we call memories. Of course, it's a hypothesis to assert that that instantaneous state of affairs has a correlation with past events, with other parts of that multiplicity. But we're going to make that as a fundamental assumption in physics, and we couldn't do physics without it. But it's that idea that the configurations of the universe, at least during certain epochs, in the instance contain records of the past. In other words, they contain what Barber calls time capsules. That's why time is in the instance and not the instance in time. Time is, in a sense, the multiplicity, but the records of time, the time capsules, are in the instance. So this is just another aspect of time. It's not a metric notion, but it's another aspect of the way we come to understand time in our own lives, because we have access to records of the past, or at least we think we do. Well, there are many, many other aspects of time. Does time flow, which is a question that Leah's brought up. I'm going to concentrate for a moment on the question of the connection between time and clocks. Well, I mentioned thermodynamics, and let me just say why I did that. Well, in a sense, I gave the game away. Thermodynamics, the laws of thermodynamics don't contain d by dt's, nor do the equations of state. So in other words, there's no temporal metric in thermodynamics. Of course, there's time. Thermodynamics is full of statements about time. Look in particular at the second law of thermodynamics, where it says something about entropy either staying the same or increasing for certain kinds of processes. The time is there all. Just think of a Carnot cycle. So if we have the state, we have some state space. Maybe we're looking here at P and V. And then we're thinking of a typical Carnot cycle, where if I remember correctly, these are the isotherms and these are the adiabats. We're looking at a Carnot cycle following all of these states quasi-statically. Well, where would we be without having an hour of time? We're following these states around in time. We just don't attribute any metric to this theory, and there are no clocks. So clearly, it's not required for a theory to have time that there are clocks in the theory. But now, some of you will be aware that in 1909, Cara Theodore, who used to be a student of Minkowski, did to the state space what Minkowski did to relativity. That's to say, he geometrized it. So Cara Theodore introduced the idea of an abstract n-dimensional differential manifold, which is the state space, the set of all possible equilibrium states of a thermal system like a gas, and then introduced a relation on between points on that state space, which is called adiabatic accessibility. And it's a little bit like causal accessibility, roughly speaking, in Minkowski space-time. It's a little bit like causal accessibility. It has different mathematical properties and so on. But to say, for example, that two points are adiabatically inaccessible is a little bit like saying two points are causally inaccessible in Minkowski space-time. Now, Minkowski assumed, this was his postulate, that for any neighborhood of a point in that manifold, there exists at least one other point inside that neighborhood that's adiabatically inaccessible from the first one. Now, by assuming a number of continuity assumptions and so on, Cara Theodore very elegantly was able to show that there's a foliation of the state space, and for every continuous curve on a foliation that corresponds to a quasi-static reversible change, you can label the foliations by way of a function, a state function, which is S, which is the entropy. And furthermore, if you take two points that are not on the same foliation and are not related, do not have this relationship of adiabatic accessibility, then it turns out there's a difference in entropy. Well, we knew that to start with. But in going from one to the other, the entropy always either increases or always decreases. Now, this is weaker than the second law of thermodynamics, because the second law of thermodynamics tells you, or at least a conclusion of, say, the standard Kelvin law of thermodynamics, is that entropy always increases, or at least it either stays the same or it increases for these kinds of irreversible processes. This is a weaker statement. All such processes involve either an increase of entropy uniformly, or all such processes universally involve a decrease of entropy. And Cara Theodore said, go out and find out which it is. This is an empirical question. But now a problem arises. With respect to what? It increases or decreases with respect to what? With respect to what arrow? You've got two mathematical possibilities. But if I'm saying, for example, well, I'm going to go out and see if entropy increases in one of these irreversible processes, how do I know which direction of time I'm looking at to start with? I mean, when we're comparing directions in time, don't we always we're comparing two different distinct processes and comparing to see whether they act in the same direction or not? But come to think of it, coming back to this process, say, what did we mean when we said that that point was later than that point inside our Carnot cycle? What do we mean by that? What does it mean to say that one thing is later than another thing? Well, there is, you might want to think about this, and you might think you know what the answer is. Maybe I could just suggest one possibility. Lurking in the very depths of thermodynamics, there is an assumption that's so important that some people think it's normally not named. Some people have recently named it the minus first law of thermodynamics. And this is the claim that when a system is away from equilibrium, all of these points here represent equilibrium states of a system. But of course, the system may not be in equilibrium. We may force all the molecules of a gas into one side of a container and then take away the barrier, and let's see what happens. The claim in thermodynamics, which is mostly implicit, but it's always there, is that the system will spontaneously approach equilibrium, a unique state of equilibrium given the conditions, and it will remain there forever. Now, there's an analogy, as we saw, those of us who are going to Eric Poisson's lectures will have seen, there is an analogy in black hole, the thermodynamics of black hole mechanics, which is the claim that when you have a black hole, there are no future caustics in the event horizon. That's a fundamental defining feature of a black hole, and that establishes the difference between future and past. So now if we ask ourselves, does Carathéodory's entropy increase for these kinds of processes universally, or does it decrease? Well, what do we mean by before and after? At least we have something already established, which is that there's an asymmetry in time. Systems tend towards equilibrium in one direction, and then they stay there forever. Of course, whether you call that moving into the future or the past doesn't matter, that's just a word. But now we have a standard. So when we ask ourselves, what do we mean by Carathéodory's question, referring back to that standard defined by the minus first law, then we know what we mean. Now we know what we mean. But I think it's probably the case that even in general relativity, when we're doing black hole thermodynamics, we should be asking ourselves, when we write down that the area of a black hole could only increase, we should be asking ourselves, what era of time are we defining that with respect to? So maybe we should appeal to the fact that we've already introduced an era of time because we've assumed that the event horizon is a strictly a time asymmetric thing. Now, interesting question arises just before I leave thermodynamics. I mentioned thermodynamics doesn't have clocks. It doesn't have a temporal metric. It doesn't have a notion of duration. What about general relativity? Well, general relativity, by way of black holes, gives rise to some very interesting thermodynamical behavior. And in one of Lee's lectures, there was a very nice discussion of this recent suggestion of Ted Jacobson, that you can actually sort of turn the arguments around, and you can start with thermodynamic notions in space-time and derive the Einstein field equations as an equation of state. Now, if that's the right way of thinking about it, why do we expect to see a temporal metric occurring? I'm just leaving that question open for the moment, because I'm going to come back to it. Why would we expect a temporal metric to arise in general relativity any more than it arises in thermodynamics? I'll come back to that. Okay. I'm now going to define two events exactly where I am. I'm stationary in space, and I'm going to define two events. And I want to know, what do I mean when I say that there's a temporal duration between those two events? Or indeed, even if I think I know what that means, how do I compare that temporal duration with the temporal duration between two later events? We cannot catch a fleeting minute and put it alongside a later minute, said Mill. What is going on here? What do we mean by duration? There's a very nice paper that George Francis Fitzgerald, of the famous Fitzgerald-Lorentz deformation hypothesis, wrote before he died in the late 19th century, where he raised what he called, well, what might be called the problem of the standard of time. Now, many of you will be aware of the fact that at the end of the 19th century, the best clock that we had for any purposes whatsoever was the rotation of the Earth. In fact, if the Earth didn't have such a stable rotation, such a regular rotation, it's hard to imagine how astronomy could have got off the ground, at least quantitative astronomy and planetary dynamics. So Fitzgerald wrote, there's every reason for assuming that the Earth rotates on its axis more uniformly than any clock we can construct. But then Fitzgerald says, but wait a minute. Think about the Earth as a dynamical system. Well, It's not a rigid body. It's got tides. It's got seas on its surface. The Earth is interacting with other celestial bodies, and the moon, the sun, and so on. There are tidal forces. These produce friction. Friction produces heat. Heat radiates into space. This was a problem that Poincaré was very aware of. This is what stopped Poincaré from applying his recurrence theorem, his 1890 recurrence theorem, to celestial mechanics. Precisely this problem about friction, tidal friction in bodies, even whether or not they have seas on the surface. Wouldn't you expect that to change the rate of rotation of the Earth? Well, nowadays we know that the inner molten core of the Earth is so irregular and so complicated, not to mention the motion of the seas on the surface of the Earth, we can't predict what the Earth is going to do. We're far from being able to predict. Normally, these effects tend to slow the Earth down, but now we've realized in the last 10 years that it started to speed up again. But we can't understand why. Of course, in qualitative terms we can, but not in quantitative terms. There was also a problem that if you use the Earth as a clock and you look backwards, you retrodict to the eclipses in the ancient times, ancient history, you find there's a discrepancy with the records. And again, this is telling you independently that something's gone wrong with the Earth as a clock. And then at the beginning of the 20th century, this wasn't just mere speculation. They started to notice systematic problems with the motion of the moon, and then with as the more and more results, accurate results came out, they noticed systematic errors with anomalies with the motions of certain planets. And it was clear, well, here you have a situation where as a philosopher of science, you have to ask yourself, what are you supposed to do? Are you refuting Newtonian mechanics, or are you finding that your clock is not a very good one? Well, of course, the astronomers gave up the rotation of the Earth as a clock. And what did they choose before atomic clocks came into being? It was a period of several decades before they had atomic clocks and after they'd given up. Does anyone know the answer to that? No. Ephemeris time. Thank you, Chris. Ephemeris time. Well, ephemeris time, roughly speaking, is the following. Think of the solar system as an isolated body, and think of all the systems in the solar system, not just the planets, but their moons, any other stuff that's in the solar system, including the sun, of course. Treat the entire solar system as the clock. So all the planets, all their moons, everything, the sun, imagine them as defining the hand of a clock. So you're extrapolating time out of the motions of all the bodies. Of course, you're assuming that the solar system is isolated, which is not strictly true. But you're really using the entire dynamical system as a clock and no subsystem. In other words, you're getting Newtonian time out of all the data you've been getting by measuring the positions, the relative positions of planets successively over many years. That's roughly speaking how it works. It is a very fundamental notion of time because it's really what it's telling you is that the only true clock is the largest isolated system you have access to, which ultimately means the universe. Okay, but it's not very easy to use in practice because your data about the relative positions of planets has a certain error in it, that have systematic errors. So when atomic clocks were made available, this turned out to be more practical than using ephemeris time. But the question that Fitzgerald was raising was, if we have grounds for thinking that our best clock is not accurate, how do you change the standard of time? Doesn't that define our standard of time? Well, obviously, you need to find a better standard. Well, what is it? Now, I just wanted to say that Let's go to Einstein. We're asking the question, what is duration? And in 1905, in Einstein's famous relativity paper, Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies, clocks play a very, very important role. And when Einstein talks about inertial coordinate systems and temporal intervals between events at the same place, and Einstein says, what do we mean by those coordinate intervals? The answer is, they are being defined by the existence, the hypothetical existence of ideal clocks. So in our inertial coordinate systems, temporal intervals, the coordinate intervals are being defined by the existence of ideal clocks. But Einstein didn't say what a clock was. I mean, after all, if a clock is supposed to tick, let's imagine for the sake of argument a clock ticks. Or putting it in a slightly more sophisticated fashion, the orbit of its state in the phase space is closed. It's a loop of some kind. Okay, so it returns pretty closely or almost exactly to its initial state periodically. Or successively, I should say. I don't want to use the word periodically yet. Successively. Well, then, my heart does that more or less, and the thing on my wrist does it more or less. They both tick. So why is this one better than that one? Well, Einstein was very silent on this issue, but in 1910, he actually gave a definition of a clock, and here it is. By a clock, we understand anything characterized by a phenomenon passing periodically through identical phases, so that we must assume by virtue of the principle of sufficient reason that all that happens in a given period is identical with all that happens in an arbitrary period. Now, is that helpful? Do you think you understand now what a clock is? And by the way, how are we supposed to apply the principle of sufficient reason? How does that work? You see, if I'm comparing my heart with this watch, don't I have to know an awful lot of stuff in order to be able to conclude that my watch is actually a better clock than my heart? I mean, suppose I'm vastly ignorant. Couldn't I apply the principle of sufficient reason and say they're equally good? But what does that knowledge consist in?
What does my introduction mean? Would Einstein agree from this definition that there are, in physics, we are no ideal clocks? That is, everything that you might say is approximately satisfies this criteria is actually coupled to other degrees of freedom, is coupled to the environment and the world and so forth. And there, and by virtue of that, each revolution, each whatever ticking is slightly different, takes place under slightly different conditions. And which is indeed what you would expect. That's the way I would expect the principle of sufficient reason to be applied.
Well,
that was really my second question.
Yeah.
That is, my understanding of the principle of sufficient reason is you're supposed to use it to understand that that two moments which are different in principle must be different in reality. There must be differences in the configurations you can point to, even if they're very small.
I suspect that if you really pushed Einstein against the wall, he would say all these very sensible things. And I think if you really pushed him against the wall, he would say, by the principle of sufficient reason, I mean according to our best theories. But by the way, when you apply the principle of sufficient reason, what you really mean here is, if two intervals are different, when I have a ticking process, right? If two intervals that this clock I'm measuring are different, there has to be a reason for it. That's the application of the principle. But what is it? What is the reason? The trouble with this, I mean, I think Einstein knew perfectly well, actually, what a clock is. He just didn't say it properly. So let's not be too hard on Einstein. But I'm simply saying, if you study the 1905 paper, you won't find any definition of a clock. And that's one of the true weaknesses of the paper. Because really, if you're going to define coordinate intervals in inertial coordinate systems, which are very physical things, I don't mean concretized, but they're very, very important in physics, inertial coordinates. If you're going to define them in terms of a clock, you better say what a clock is. And here he's not really doing the issue justice. Now, there's another point of view. I'm going to try to contrast this with another point of view. Perhaps the contrast is a bit exaggerated. But at least these guys on the other side, Newton, Fitzgerald, Poincaré, and Barber, I think had their finger much more on the pulse, if you'll excuse a pun. What is duration? Well, You see, instead of saying that duration is defined by ideal clocks, it's that ideal clocks are defined by duration. Now, at first sight, that doesn't look as if it's going to be very helpful, because now you have to say what you mean by duration. But look, let's just take Newtonian mechanics for the sake of simplicity. Isn't there a T that appears in the equations of motion? If you write the equations of motion, if you write Newton's laws of motion and say putting in the gravitational force, those equations look especially simple in inertial coordinate systems. If you try any other coordinate system, things are going to become much more complicated. There's a natural home. In terms of the space of all possible coordinates, there's a natural home for Newtonian mechanics. There's a natural parameter that makes Newtonian mechanics. There's a natural temporal parameter that makes everything look simple. Okay? Of course, that parameter is only defined up to an affine transformation. But nonetheless, there is a parameter in Newtonian mechanics that makes life simple. Now, what do we mean by a clock in relation to Newtonian mechanics? We mean a subsystem of the universe, if it's going to be any use to us, I mean, apart from ephemeris time. We mean a subsystem of the universe that's ticking in accordance with that parameter. So it's theory that tells us whether a clock is a good clock, not the other way around. We're not given clocks on a plate in nature. We have to find them. And we find them on the basis of our best theories. Why do people go all the trouble to build atomic clocks? Because quantum mechanics tells you that those oscillatory processes inside the atoms are actually extremely regular. That's why we use these clocks. It's theory that informs us how to use clocks. Now, of course, that means, as Lee was suggesting, what that means is that it's going to be a very difficult process, and we're never going to get to the end of it. Every laboratory in the world that contains atomic clocks contains many of them. They have algorithms for weighting the behavior of these various clocks. They introduce a weighted average over these clocks, for example, because they realize that they have grounds for thinking that some are a little bit more stable than others. They then compare clocks in different laboratories around the world if you really want to be accurate. But ultimately, all of this is simply designed to get you with some kind of procedure that marches in step with the time that appears in our best equation, in our best theories. But look, let me just mention, raise the following issue. Do clocks measure time? We're choosing systems that have a certain periodicity because that periodicity marches in step with the time that appears in our deepest theories, dynamics, the equations of motion, most fundamental equations of motion we have, field equations, whatever. But are we measuring it? Well, let's just stop for a minute and ask ourselves, what do we mean by measurement in physics? What do we mean when we say, for example, that a thermometer measures temperature? We can put a thermometer into a heat bath, and what happens? Well, there's a dynamical interaction between the thermometer and the heat bath. Now, the heat bath acts on the thermometer, but the thermometer also acts back on the heat bath. It's just that that effect is very, very small. That's why it's a heat bath. It's a very, very, very small effect, but it's there. But this is a dynamical coupling between two physical bodies according to well-known interaction, sort of well-known laws of interaction. Is that what's happening with a clock? Now, another thing, just think of quantum mechanics. Actually, some of our best instincts about what measurements are and aren't come out of quantum mechanics. Why? Because we're constantly talking in quantum mechanics about the measurement problem. And what is it? Well, the measurement problem arises because if we have a system one, usually a microsystem, and we have another system two, which is typically a macroscopic sort of instrument with some kind of canonical pointer on it that's going to give us the outcomes of measurements, we introduce a dynamical interaction between these things. In fact, we look at the Hilbert space, the tensor product Hilbert space of these two systems. We introduce an interaction Hamiltonian that's a self-adjoint operator on that tensor product Hilbert space. This now will govern the behavior, the evolution of a state associated with these two systems. So we've got some vector that belongs to the tensor product Hilbert space. We use Schrodinger's equation. Normally, in quantum mechanics, we assume that this interaction Hamiltonian dominates the Hamiltonian. Sometimes this is called an impulsive measurement or something like that. And we can solve the equation, and we can show, for example, that if it's a reasonable measuring device, if this system starts in the in an eigenstate of the observable we're measuring, let's say spin up, then the instrument will find itself in a state at the end of that interaction that's correlated with spin up. So the pointer points, say, to the left, and we say, well, that means spin up. Okay, but on the other hand, that same interaction Hamiltonian, if we'd started in the case of a particle with spin down, then the pointer would have ended up on the other side of the scale, which means spin down. So now we have a correlation between the outcomes of this interaction. The final state of the apparatus is telling us something about the initial state of the object system. And this is now absolutely standard in the literature on the measurement problem. Why? Because we want to understand what a measurement is in quantum mechanics, and we're assuming correctly that both of these systems are quantum mechanical, and we know what the equation of motion is between them. There's nothing mysterious here. Of course, the interesting case is when we don't start with just spin up or spin down, but we start with a linear combination of spin up and spin down. And then what happens? Well, because of the linearity of the evolution operator, because of the linearity of the Schrodinger equation, of course, we end up with a superposition of the pointer and the object system being spin up, pointer this way, and then plus spin down, spin down, pointer that way. And we have to make sense of what that superposition means. But the point that I'm trying to stress here is that all of this discussion presupposes that a measurement is a dynamical coupling between two bodies, which creates a correlation between their states, the initial state of the object system and the final state of the apparatus. That's what we mean by a measurement normally. Now, just a caveat, the word measurement, again, is rather multifaceted. Because in classical mechanics, what we say is a measurement reveals the value of an observable. If you're measuring, for example, the position of a particle, what you normally say is it doesn't matter how you do it, but you're actually getting information about a pre-existing element of reality, which is the position of the particle. That doesn't happen in quantum mechanics, at least not generically. Because if I start with a system that has spin up plus spin down, some linear combination, then it's difficult, it's problematic, it's controversial as whether you can say the object has a spin at all. Well, what does it have? It has a wave function, or it has a spin wave function, but it happens to be a linear combination of spin up and spin down associated with some direction in space. So in general, in quantum mechanics, we do not discover in measurements what pre-exists. We just don't do that. Now, if you think that violates the meaning of measurement, fine, use another word. But that's the way it is in quantum mechanics generally. Depends on your interpretation to some extent. But the point that I'm trying to stress here is that usually, generically, a measurement means we interact two systems together according to our best theories, and we see how one affects the other. We see how the object system affects the apparatus. Now, is that what's happening with clocks? Do clocks interact with time? Isham made a remark the other day in his talk to the effect that clocks don't measure time because measurements take time. Now, I don't know how serious he was being, and I'm not quite sure I know what he means. But there is one way of interpreting what he said, which is just this. Clocks don't measure anything. They just do what they do. But you chose them because what they are doing happens to march in step with the T in your best theories. Now, bear this in mind, because it's important for the rest of the stuff. The clocks aren't measuring anything. And in particular, they're not measuring some abstract physical or semi-metaphysical thing called time. Time is not a dynamical variable. There's nothing like an interaction Hamiltonian that's associated with the behavior of a clock. A clock is just doing what it's doing. And so the better the clock, the more isolated it is from the rest of the universe. So the lower the value of the interaction Hamiltonian. OK. Sure.
No. For exactly the same reason. But when I say they don't measure, there's a sense in which, of course, that correlation is like a measurement.
I'm just saying they don't measure in the way that a thermometer does. They don't measure in the way that a storm Gerlach device measures. This is another notion of measurement. It's simply a correlation. But you're certainly gaining information by having a clock. It's just that the clock is not being acted upon from without. It's just doing what it's doing.
From what used to be called measurement, is a measurement result. And in the case of, say, length, if you take a meter stick and a measurement object from the view, the result is 2 meters.
Sure.
The result of that comparison is a particular physical quality.
Fair enough.
Why would you want to call that a measurement, even though there's no interaction between meter stick and meter stick?
Fair enough. I don't want to get hung up on linguistic terms. If you want to say this is a measurement, that's fine. I'm just saying it's not a measurement in the sense that a thermometer measures. It's not a measurement in the sense of a quantum measurement. It's something else. But that's fine. It's still a measurement of sorts. So that's why I put measure here in inverted commas. I don't want to say it's not a measurement. It's just not a measurement of a certain kind.
And here is something, there is no idle clock. What do you mean by idle? There's no idle clock.
What I mean is a system in the universe, a subsystem of an isolated subsystem of the universe, which has a periodicity that marches exactly in step with the temporal parameter in our best theories, our most fundamental theory. And this is simply because there's no such thing as an isolated system.
So we define the things that we have right now as an ideal one.
We have the atomic clocks, and indeed some. I understand that some rotating pulsars are as periodic, are as stable as our best atomic clocks. So there are two rivals now. I think the best clock in the universe. There is the best atomic clocks. I'm not sure. Maybe that. Bose-Einstein condensate to be able to produce better clocks. But at the moment, I think we have atomic clocks and we have certain pulsars, which are regarded about as equally accurate. But neither of them are, I mean, there's no particular, we can't look at it, we can't point to an object in the universe and say that's an ideal clock.
Because if you say that this is not ideal, it means that you know what is an ideal and you can measure it.
Well, the standard is exactly the T that appears in the equations. Is the thing that systematizes the equations into their simplest form. That's what we mean. That's the standard. But that's an abstract thing. What we want is a physical thing that I can put on the table. So that, for example, when we measure pulsars that are actually producing gravitational waves, I can compare their periodicity with our best clocks on Earth. Okay, so I want to have something here and now which is relatively isolated and manipulable, so that I can compare these different things, and I can test Einstein's field equations.
In which this was not possible, in which all the physics that we did was correlate some measurement that you gave of some degree of freedom with some measurement of some other degree of freedom. And that might be it. And if you read, Carlo Rovelli's stuff about time in general to the quantum gravity, that's really all that's being referred to. Do you think it's a contingent fact or a necessary fact that we happen to live in a world where it's well described by theories which have this property that there are simplest forms?
I think it's entirely contingent.
And therefore, it might be only true to some level of approximation.
Yeah, I can't see any a priori reason why it has to be like that. Now, you might say thermodynamics is a nice example because there just isn't any metric. But of course, the trouble with thermodynamics is we know it's not a fundamental theory. Mm-hmm. But by the way, if if Jacobson is right and many others, neither is general relativity. And yet it has a metric. So I want, this is a point I want to come back to later. I don't see why the universe couldn't have been such that they just aren't. Let's put it this way. One of the truly remarkable things about the world we live in, truly remarkable, is that if you construct a clock using something like a strong force, just for the sake of argument, I'm talking loosely here, and you compare it to an electromagnetic clock, up to an affine transformation, they tick at the same rate. Why should that be? Why should the T inside the equations for the strong force be the same up to an affine transformation as the T that appears in electromagnetism? This universality is really an amazing thing. Some people attribute it to the very nature of space-time. It's an amazing thing. It's a very profound thing. And who's to say the world has to be like that? Sorry, Tom. Go ahead. What I'm saying is, it's probably a consequence, or it's closer related to the fact, and again, we'll come back to this in general relativity, that think of Lorentz covariance. The strong force is part of a Lorentz covariant theory. Now, what does Lorentz covariance mean? It means that if you take the form of the theory in a particular coordinate system, and you do a boost, then the form of that theory will look the same in the boosted coordinate system. This is also a feature of electromagnetism. In fact, it was discovered by way of electromagnetism. But why should those sets of coordinates be the same? Why is Lorentz covariance defined with respect to the same sets of coordinate systems for these two forces? Okay. I'd like to pass on, if I may, to the second notion of duration. And this has to do with, we've been talking about what a clock is, what it means to say that something is a good clock. Now I want to understand is, what do we mean, what happens when we put the clock into motion? Now, of course, I'm going to quickly say what time dilation is. I don't need to dwell on this in this audience. You all know what it is. According to Einstein, and not just Einstein, there were premonitions before Einstein, and I'll come back to that. Suppose we have an inertial coordinate system, and we have two clocks at rest, A and B, that are separated in space. And let's suppose we synchronize them. How do we do that, by the way? I'll come back to that. Let's suppose we know what we mean by synchrony, synchronization. This is a big caveat, and really, in a way, I'm never sure whether I should introduce this topic before or after the discussion of simultaneity. But bear in mind, we're going to synchronize these clocks, two stationary clocks that are synchronized. Now, we have a third identical clock. They're all ideal. It doesn't matter what they're made of. And this third clock is moving at a uniform speed with respect to our inertial frame. So it's passing, as it were, this clock and this clock. And we're measuring the time that it takes on the moving clock for that passage between A and B. And we call that the proper time because it's read by a single clock. And the question now is, what is the connection between the proper time and the coordinate times associated with these two synchronized clocks between A and B? Now, of course, that to define that, you need two synchronized clocks at different places because the events in question on the world line of C are in different places in our coordinate system. And that ratio is not equal to 1, and that's time dilation. But notice, it does depend on how I synchronize these clocks. Now, Einstein wasn't the first to think about time dilation. There were premonitions of time dilation. Joseph Larmor, who was one of the great ether theorists, one of the great experts on electromagnetism, the predecessor of Dirac at Cambridge, was looking at Maxwell's equations in a style very similar to the way Lorentz was, and this problem of the electrodynamics of moving bodies. And he convinced himself that if you took two oppositely charged bodies, which were orbiting each other in a stable way, of course it's not stable, but imagine just for the sake of argument, these two bodies are orbiting each other, and you put this into uniform motion, then Maxwell's equations tell you, it's not a question of transforming to the rest frame of moving bodies, you just make a calculation, or you can use the symmetries of Maxwell's equations, and you can show that the period of their orbit will be affected by the motion. And in fact, it will pick up a dilation factor of gamma, 1 minus v squared over c squared to the minus 1/2. Okay, so this little orbiting pair of charged particles is a clock, and Larmor predicted that it would dilate. And this was around 1897. And by the way, this is clearly, this was the inspiration, although he doesn't say it very explicitly, this really was the inspiration for Bell's famous paper, How to Teach Special Relativity, in 1976. Almost exactly the same time, maybe a year later, independently, well, in 1888, the French physicist Léonard asked the following question. Of course, the Michelson-Morley experiment, which involves an optical Michelson interferometer, which is rotated in space, checking to see whether there's a shift in the interference patterns, interference fringes, was the first second-order ether-wind experiment, ether-wind test, and it gave a null result. And the explanation of this extraordinary, unexpected result was given by Fitzgerald and then Lorentz independently. They had exactly the same idea. The stone block on which those mirrors are mounted undergoes a deformation when in motion with respect to the ether. Okay? Let's just think of Fitzgerald for the moment. How did he get this idea? Doesn't it just seem like magic? Fitzgerald had been corresponding with the great English autodidact, Oliver Heaviside, the guy, incidentally, who put Maxwell's equations into three-vector form and did many, many other important things. Heaviside was asking himself the following question. If you take a charge that's at rest with respect to the ether. Now, what do I mean by the ether here? I just mean the frame in which Maxwell's equations are valid. You have an inertial coordinate system. Maxwell's equations are valid in that, with respect to that coordinate system. What is the electrostatic field surrounding a spherical distribution of charge? Well, it has spherical symmetry. So the surfaces of equipotential are spherical. Now, what happens if you take that charge and put it into motion? It's a uniform motion. What's going to happen to the surface of equipotential? Can anyone tell me? What will happen to the surface of equipotential of a charge moving through the ether? Better put, moving with respect to the frame in which Maxwell's equations are valid. What's going to happen to it? It's going to become an ellipsoid, later called the Heaviside ellipsoid. It's going to get squashed in the direction of motion. Okay? Now, this was a solution of Maxwell's equations that Heaviside found. Not by brute force, but more or less guessing. He sort of stumbled across it, but he found it. Now, Fitzgerald said to himself, that stone block on which the mirrors are mounted, what if the intermolecular forces were like electrostatic forces? Nobody knew at the time what they were. Well, suppose they're like electrostatic forces. If you put this thing into motion, the electrostatic forces in the longitudinal direction are going to become, are going to change. In fact, there's going to be a change, a deformation in the shape of the body. This is a very interesting dynamical argument. This was not an ad hoc hypothesis. It was an extrapolation from Heaviside's result to the case of intermolecular forces inside solid bodies. Good. That's the beginning of length contraction. Now, Léonard came along, and by the way, you don't have to assume that it's longitudinal, and both Fitzgerald and Lorentz realized this. It could be You could have a longitudinal length change. It could even be an expansion. And you can have a transverse length change that could be expansion, as long as the ratio is equal to gamma. As long as the ratio is equal to gamma. So it's better to call this shape deformation than length contraction. Now, Leonard came along and said, OK, let's redo the Michelson-Morley experiment, but this time immersed in some kind of medium, transparent medium, with a non-trivial refractive index. Now what? Well, it didn't take long for people to, they did the, of course, they could calculate this just doing standard optics, and they discovered that even if you allow for the Lorentz Fitzgerald deformation, you will not get a null result. It's not enough, if you're looking for a null result, it's not enough to put in the Lorentz Fitzgerald deformation. Well, it's a remarkable thing that by this stage, people were so, they had seen so many ether wind experiments that they decided, and Lorentz in particular, decided this wouldn't give a positive result either. So Lorentz sat down and tried to figure out what would he need to introduce in order to get a null result. And what he pointed out was that the source of light, which are oscillating electrons that are radiating, that oscillation defines a frequency. That means that it's a clock, and it's going to have to dilate when it's in motion with respect to the frame of reference with respect to Maxwell's equations about it. So this is a second case of time dilation. This internal clock inside the light source is going to have to dilate exactly by the factor gamma. Now, is this time dilation? Well, what had been shown was that a little rotating system of oppositely charged bodies, which is a clock, will dilate, and oscillating electrons inside a solid, or inside some sort of body, are also going to, that the frequency is going to dilate. But what about my heart? Or what about something else? What about some other kind of clock, some kind of very sophisticated mechanical clock? What will it do? Wasn't so clear. It certainly wasn't the case that either of these famous figures convinced themselves that this was a universal effect. But by the way, come to think of it, why should it be? Why should it be universal? Why should a clock dilate independent of how it's built? Now, let's go back to the Michelson-Morley experiment. At the beginning of the century, Michelson himself thought, well, okay, the stone block may deform when it's moving with respect to the ether, but suppose we build it out of wood. Or suppose we build a platform out of metal, steel, iron. How do we know that the deformation will be exactly the right kind to produce a null result? So he went and tested it and discovered that in all these cases, the deformation was exactly the same. Isn't that kind of miraculous? We're beginning to see the emergence of kinematics, because kinematics is a form of universalized behavior of certain kinds of bodies. And the minute you talk about universal behavior, you should also start thinking geometry. That's really, in a sense, what we mean partly by geometry in physics. It's something associated with a universal pattern amongst bodies of very, very different kinds of structure, composition. At any rate, it was really Einstein who came along and said, well, time dilation is a real thing, and it holds for all ideal clocks independent of their constitution. Now, where did he get that from? Well, Einstein was the first to realize systematically that the coordinate transformations contain physics. And in particular, if you write down linear transformations between inertially relatively moving coordinate systems, as a very general rule, and this encompasses Galilean transformations or Lorentz transformations, as long as they're linear, the temporal coordinate transformation is going to look like this. 1 minus alpha v times the dilation factor times t minus alpha x. What is alpha? It's the relativity of simultaneity term. So for example, we have two coordinate systems in the standard configuration. One is passing the other at speed v along the x, x prime axis. Okay? And what we mean is that if this is the t and the x, this is the space-time diagram from the point of view of the original, the unprimed observer. This is the t prime is equal to 0 locus of events with respect to the moving observer. And alpha will be the tangent of the angle between those. That will be a simultaneity slice with respect to the moving observer. This is the simultaneity slice hyperplane with respect to the unmoving observer, the S observer. And the tangent of that angle is alpha. So it's the relativity of simultaneity term. And notice that it appears here outside that bracket as well. And that's the time dilation term, if any. Time dilation defined in exactly the way I meant before. So when you go through the Einstein derivation of the Lorentz transformations, and I'm not going to worry about what that looks like, of course you end up with t prime is equal to gamma t minus vx over c squared, so that we have that the dilation factor is equal to gamma, and alpha is equal to v over c squared. Where does that come from? That exists whether or not there's time dilation. And in fact, all that historically this came from, Poincaré was the first to realize in relativity theory, prior to relativity theory, that is merely a consequence of the way you synchronize your clocks in both frames. It does not depend on the existence of an invariant velocity. So I'll come back to that after the break. That term there is merely a consequence of the way you've synchronized your clocks. However, Einstein's postulates also imply the existence of an invariant velocity. Imply it. They don't presuppose it. It's a theorem of the postulates. And ultimately, if you assume the isotropy of space, you got the Lorentz transformations. And that means the dilation factor is gamma. You got time dilation. But Einstein is presupposing all the time that this is kinematics in the sense that any ideal clock will behave in that way. How do you justify that? How do you justify the claim that any ideal clock, independent of its constitution, is going to dilate in the same way? Well, for Einstein, it was merely a postulate. It's an implicit postulate. Otherwise, you don't have kinematics in the usual sense of the word. Now, let's say we all understand time dilation. It's just a physical effect. You're all familiar with the famous twin experiment with clock retardation. So there's Professor Kaluza, who stays at home, and he sends his arch enemy out in a rocket ship, thinking that something terrible will happen to him. So Professor Klein goes shooting out in that direction in our space-time diagram. They both have identical clocks. And to Professor Kaluza's enormous surprise, Professor Klein comes back younger. And that's just a consequence of time dilation, and there's just no doubt about it. This is a physical fact. Now, one of the interesting things, because of the universality of this effect for clocks, think of this as being not a space-time diagram, think of it as being a space diagram. So we have a point in space here, a point in space there, and a point in space here. And now we have two vehicles that are driving along this distance, and one driving along that distance, and they're comparing the lengths on their hodometers, or odometers. I don't know what you call them here in Canada. The thing on your car that measures distance. Say again? Odometer, or, okay. Well, how did people do these distance measurements before there were cars with odometers? Well, in the late 19th century, well, the late 18th century, people used things like these. These were waywisers. These were very, very nice devices that were attached to the back of carriages that were drawn by horses between cities along more or less straight roads. And of course, you can measure the distance by counting the number of revolutions of the wheel. The number of revolutions is reflected on the dial. Why did the maker of this waywiser have a premonition of relativity? What does the dial look like? A clock. A clock is a waywiser of space-time. because a clock measures distances along time-like world lines. Because why? Because space-time has a Minkowski geometry. Of course, it's not like Euclidean geometry, because the crooked line on a flat two-dimensional surface is longer than a straight one. In a Minkowski geometry, the Wei-Weiser does exactly the opposite. The clock along here ticks 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times, and the clock along here ticks 10 times. But the clock is a Wei-Weiser of space-time. Now, let me just ask the following question. How does this thing work? Is this a measurement? Or is it just a measurement? Is it like the thermometer? Or is it like a clock? It's more like a thermometer, isn't it? Because without friction, without an interaction with the road, the number of revolutions would have nothing to do with the length. So there's a dynamical interaction between the wheel and the surface of the road, the surface of the Earth, and this interaction produces rotation of the wheel and so on. So it's a bit more like a thermometer, isn't it? It's a bit more like this quantum mechanical interaction. But what about the clock? How does the space-time Wei-Weiser work? Well, I've argued before, it doesn't measure anything. It just does what it does. And after all, when you think about it, there's no friction in space-time. It's not space-time, is it, that's making the clock do what it does? So there does seem to be a disanalogy here. I'm not saying it's not measuring. I'm just saying it's not measuring in inverted commas in the same way that a temperature measures. So after all, maybe it's good for us to think that this thing is not a measurement in the strong sense, because it takes away a lot of the puzzlement we often have about how to explain this result. I mean, after all, and later on when we talk about how we synchronize distant clocks, clock transport is a way of synchronizing distant clocks. And if you think clocks are measuring something, it becomes very strange as to why it is that clock transport is not a good method for synchronizing distant clocks. So I'm just saying there is this curious relationship between time and clocks. Clocks really aren't measuring in the strong sense. And then this doesn't look quite as strange. However, the question arises, how to explain time dilation? So here are a number of options. You may think of other options. Here are a number of options. Well, you can explain time dilation. After all, didn't Einstein derive it from his postulates? Isn't that an explanation of sorts? Einstein assumed the relativity principle. He assumed the light postulate, which was? Anyone tell me what the light postulate was? What does constancy mean? Invariance?
He assumed that with respect to a constant.
I know, but there's constancy and then there's invariance. And Einstein uses the two words very carefully. Constancy is the claim that with respect to a given coordinate system, he called it the resting frame, the speed of light, the two-way speed of light, the to and fro speed of light, is independent of the speed of the source and isotropic. Independent of the speed of the source and isotropic. Yeah. No, the average of going to. He doesn't say this, by the way. He refers to the one-way speed, but he really shouldn't have. Because later he independently introduces a convention about how to go from a two-way to a one-way speed. It's much cleaner to define the light postulate in terms of a two-way speed and leave the convention out of it for the moment about how you get one-way speeds. But anyway, from those two assumptions, Einstein derives the invariance of the two-way speed of light. So it's a consequence of the two postulates, the invariance of the two-way speed. Then he introduces a convention which goes back to Poincaré, which we'll come back to after the break, about how to synchronize clocks in both frames, and that gives you this term. And then the invariance of the one-way speed of light, because now you can talk about one-way speed because you've got synchronized clocks, determines along with the isotropy of space, that's very important, the Lorentz transformations, and Einstein assumes that they're kinematical, They're universal, and so therefore clocks have to dilate. That's an explanation of sorts. Heck of a lot better than nothing. But then you might say, well, wait a minute, we've just seen how a clock is a way wiser of space-time. Isn't it nicer to put it into a geometrical language? Isn't it the case that clocks do what they do because of the nature of Minkowski's space-time? So really, the ultimate explanation of time dilation occurs because space-time has a certain metric on it. It's a four-dimensional, very non-trivial, non-Euclidean metric. Well, how much weight you put on it depends on what you think clocks are doing and whether or not you think clocks measure time. But there's a third option, and this is certainly the one that Einstein came back to more and more as he got older. You really need to appeal to what a clock is made of. A clock does what it does because of what it's made of and because of the nature of the forces of cohesion that hold that clock together and make it tick. And that ultimately means appealing to the Lorentz covariance of the fundamental interactions inside that clock, and they could be a result of the strong interaction, the weak interaction, the predominantly the electromagnetic interaction. They're all Lorentz covariant. What's our best theory? Quantum mechanics. This stuck in Einstein's throat. Didn't like to say it very often, because he didn't much like quantum mechanics, or at least the standard interpretation. But ultimately, clocks do what they do because the fundamental non-gravitational interactions are Lorentz covariant. And because all the forces are Lorentz covariant with respect to the same frames, you can explain why every clock of every possible constitution does the same thing. In other words, by starting with the Lorentz covariance of the matter interactions, you can explain why this effect is universal. If you assume that all of these fundamental forces are Lorentz covariant with respect to the same frames. So which is your favorite explanation of time dilation? Do you start with these generalized, almost like thermodynamic principles? Einstein and Felt used thermodynamics as a methodological template when he developed special relativity. He said this very explicitly, and he referred over and over again to the thermodynamic nature of special relativity. Or do you explain it by appealing to geometric arguments that came in 1908, that were anticipated, by the way, by Poincaré in 1906, 1905? Or do you appeal to the Lorentz covariance of the fundamental quantum mechanical theory of matter, because it has to be quantum? We don't have a theory of stable matter if it's not quantum mechanical.
Is the quantum theory that described the matter did not satisfy the 1905 principles, then that would not succeed?
Not quite. It's got to satisfy Lorentz covariance. But whether that means that our best theory of light satisfies the light postulate is another question. It doesn't follow automatically. Maybe we could come back to that in discussion. Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to say here is, if you start with the Lorentz covariance as your fundamental principle, and Einstein did this more and more as he got older. In fact, on the next slide, I mentioned why Einstein had misgivings about his 1905, his 1905 approach. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but we could come back to it. But amongst other things, he did not like the special role that light plays in his theory. It shouldn't be playing a privileged role. He was embarrassed by this. Because Lorentz covariance is a universal feature of all the fundamental forces, not just the electromagnetic force. So to pick out one particular manifestation gave the wrong impression. It's not a theory ultimately about light.
Anyway, maybe we can come back to this if people like. But he also had serious misgivings about the whole approach, this thermodynamic approach, special relativity, based on these fundamental principles. Well, the answer to the question I've just raised is going to affect how you understand special relativity as a limiting case of general relativity. How is it in general relativity, how do you derive the fact that the clocks dilate in general relativity. Well, you might say, well, the theory is a metric theory, and we have this dynamical object called g mu nu. We have a metric field, and this is the solution of some equation, Einstein's field equations, some constant times t mu nu, where t mu nu represents, amongst other things, the matter degrees of freedom. And somehow out of all of that, it had better be that matter, when you build a clock out of matter that's represented by t mu nu, it had better be that it dilates. How do you prove it? How do you prove it? If you look at the form of that equation just by itself, you will never be able to prove that a clock dilates. It's just not in the nature of the form of that equation. By the way, what I'm saying here is, it's not so different from saying the following. If you knew Newton's second law of motion, you could never predict that gravity was an inverse square law. It's just not in the nature of the law. It's too general. It's too general. It's too universal. For every interaction, there will be a force expression, which you plug into the left-hand side of the equation, F is equal to ma. What does that equation mean? Is it just a definition? Of course not. It's got physics in it. And the physics is the claim that whenever you have some kind of fundamental force in nature, you will be able to find an expression like gm1m2 over d squared that you can plug in here. This is just a placeholder for an expression that will give you the right accelerations. But this equation itself doesn't tell you whether it'll be an inverse square law or anything else. And similarly, this equation here doesn't tell you what the matter is going to be like when you build rods and clocks. So how do you determine, how do you fix the local validity of special relativity? It's no good saying in general relativity, well, the tangent spaces to this curved space-time are Minkowskian. Well, they look it, but that's just a mathematical fact. Unless you put in very special constraints on the way that the matter fields, so-called matter fields like the electromagnetic field, couples to g mu nu, you're not going to get out a local representation of the world that looks like special relativity. And by the way, special relativity is not, in general relativity, the situation where that becomes Minkowski spacetime. Because that's a vacuum solution, there's no matter around, and there are no rods and clocks. And it's just the wrong way of thinking about it. The right way of thinking about it is, we live in a world with curvature and we live in a world with matter. Under what conditions can we find patches of space-time where we can ignore the Einstein field equations and just concentrate on the behavior of matter? And it turns out you can find such patches. And it turns out, because of the strong equivalence principle, listening, that the behavior of those rods and clocks will be governed by Lorentz covariant laws of physics. Now, why does that come about? Because you're adding an extra ingredient to general relativity. In a sense, that thermodynamic analogy is the right one. If you think of this as an equation of state, you would never imagine necessarily that you would get out a temporal metric. In the sense of a metric, time does not live in general relativity primordially. If you were just given the field equations, you would not necessarily know that it was a temporal metric. That there might not be any clocks, just like in thermodynamics. The reason that there are clocks, and the reason that we have a temporal metric in general relativity, and the reason that things therefore look special relativistic locally, because of this extra assumption we have to make, which is not imposed by the field equations. You just put it in by hand, essentially. This is the so-called strong equivalence principle. And it's got two components. All non-gravitational interactions, well, first of all, you take a point in space-time, an event, and you define very special local coordinates with respect to that event. Do you remember how they go? The coordinates diagonalize the metric at that point, and they make the first derivatives of the metric vanish at that point. Okay? With respect to that very special coordinate system, and all the coordinate systems you get by way of rotations and translation, well, not translations and boosts, you're going to assume that all the non-gravitational interactions, things like Maxwell's theory and electromagnetic interactions, all the rest of it, they pick out the same privileged local frames, which are these special freely falling Lorentz frames I've mentioned, with respect to which they're Lorentz covariant. All of them. So this miracle of the coincidence of the Lorentz covariance amongst the different forces, non-gravitational interactions, is just assumed in general relativity. You have to put it in by hand. And that means that when you're constructing rods and clocks out of these matter fields, they're going to behave locally. If you're doing physics where you don't have to worry about tidal effects, because they're always there, no matter how small the region is in space-time, they're always there. But if you can ignore them, if you're doing physics that just doesn't matter how big that tidal effect is or how small, then everything is going to start looking like special relativity, provided one other thing happens, that those forces, when they're expressed in terms of, when the field equations are expressed in these special frames, you do not see any sign at that point of the curvature tensor or any of its contractions. This is called minimal coupling. Where did that come from? Who ordered that? You've got to put it in. Otherwise, if you don't have these special conditions holding, you do not get time in any ordinary sense of the word in general relativity. At least you don't get a metric notion of time, and in particular, you don't get time dilation. And this sort of makes sense because, after all, you start with a theory. It may not have time in it. It may have even a kind of a thermodynamical feel to it. You might consider these to be equations of state, if you like, the sort of Jacobson approach. It's one possibility amongst others, ways of understanding GR. G mu nu is not the fabric of space-time. It's just a field. Okay, it has dynamical degrees of freedom. Now, the reason that we consider it to be space-time is because in the ordinary theory, it has chronometric significance. That's to say, freely falling test bodies built out of matter move along the geodesics of G mu nu through a certain approximation. Light, electromagnetism, traces out the null geodesics. That's a consequence of the strong equivalence principle. Rods and clocks measure intervals that are defined, and clocks in particular, measure the proper time, which turns out to be exactly related to the integral of ds, where ds is given by the metric. So all of a sudden, the metric, because of this principle here, starts to look like space and time. But don't forget, the rods and the clocks are not measuring anything in the strong sense. They're just doing what they're doing. But because they do what they do, and you've chosen them correctly, you're assigning a kind of a new operational significance to G mu nu. And that's for after the break. Are there any questions so far?
An approach that all varieties of Newtonian mechanics, where you can, for example, show that given a system of three bodies satisfying motion, you can prove that there will be a clock among those three bodies, just given the dynamics of it. It seems like you could try to prove something similar to general relativity, but just given the view of the in an appropriate limit, that particle will make that sense,
namely
something proper time.
Well, you can, of course, if you take something like a time-like curve in space-time in general relativity, and you define two events along that curve, two distant events along that curve, you can use the integral of the ds to calculate the distance along the curve. What does that have to do with time?
What does the integral of ds have to do with what a clock does? Suppose that world line is the world line of the clock. How can you be sure that it'll measure it? How can you be sure it'll be correlated with it? How do you know you even have to?
You can show if the clock satisfies the motion in the Newtonian case that there will be a way for time in terms of motion. I think it's two bodies.
Yeah, but that's just ephemeris time. That's ephemeris time. Otherwise, you could say, for example, in Newtonian mechanics, you could take one body and move it very, 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 very far from the others and use it as a clock. Why? Because to a very good approximation, it's moving inertially. Because there's no forces acting on it. Now, a body that's moving inertially doesn't tick, but it's still a clock. Because it moves equal distances and equal times. So you can make time into distance. Now you take that clock, and then you ask yourself, are the other bodies moving according to Newton's laws of motion in conformity with that original inertial clock? And the answer is yes. So in Newtonian mechanics, you can use the bodies either by isolating them or by just looking at ephemeris time. Time will emerge in the equations of motion. But it's not clear to me you get something equivalent to that in general relativity if you just look at the field equations. And you don't say anything about the way matter couples to G mu.
Sorry, I was just
thinking
about the idea that you just saw conservation of the Einstein sensor that's on the limit of the. And then you can claim that the body can be long after using the measure of proper time, long range of time work.
But then that's just true.
That's true
by definition. I mean, but what if you take a body? I mean, what if you construct a body that's first of all, it has to be freely falling. How does it tick? You're saying simply that you could mark on it.
What I'm suggesting, and maybe this is worked out, that there's a solution to the existence of an idea of law follows general relativity in the same way it follows Newtonian mechanics.
I think I see what you mean. You're saying a freely falling body will, because of the form of the field equations, will follow a geodesic. Approximately. The geodesic itself has a, you can define a distance along the geodesic by just using the metric. And so you can, yes. Maybe that's true. But it certainly isn't the kind of clock we normally use in our laboratories. I'll have to think about that, Chris. That's a good point.
One of the notions you brought up was idealized clocks, and the examples you chose were very precise examples, whether they're binary pulsar or atomic clocks. But I'm not sure precision is a good criterion for an idealized clock, and the example I'm thinking of is one, a clock which actually doesn't tick. There's no pulses, and that's cosmological time, where you measure the temperature in the CMB. And of course, as the universe evolves, the temperature decreases. And disparate points across the universe can each measure cosmological time independently. They're not actually measuring the ticks of a clock, but in the sense of thermodynamics, cosmological time seems more similar to an actual measurement, where the question of precision comes from the duration of how long you make your measurement, just like a thermometer. So I'm worrying about that.
Anybody have a view on this?
It happens to be, from the point of view of general relativity, it's a contingent and unlikely fact that there is such a degree of freedom that is a thermodynamic degree of freedom that can be synchronized everywhere across space, or at least everywhere that we can see within a horizon. The universe is so close to being symmetrical. And we take advantage of it, and we take good advantage of it. One of two things is true. Either that has fundamental significance, in which case general relativity is missing something, or that is a accidental fact of the universe being so symmetrical, etc., that that we take advantage of that, but that is not a guide to, say, a general interpretation of what time is in general relativity, for generic solutions. And there is a moment in which, in every discussion, or many discussions, I don't know what you think about this, and we're going to come to simultaneity. There's a moment when somebody says, but there is a preferred frame of simultaneity in nature, in spite of we say there's a principle, there isn't one.
No.
And in general relativity, it's clear that that's accidental. Whether it has a deeper significance, I think, is provocative. But,
well, that was helpful. Should we have a break?
Good.
Should we say 10 minutes?
15.